Itt tehát tovább haladunk, és a következő előadásra térünk át, amely asztrofizikai témájú lesz, és Mária Lugaro fogja tartani, aki ugyan már 6 éve egy lendületprogram keretében érkezett Magyarországra, és ezért kiválóan beszél hétköznapi magyar nyelven, de azért a tudományos előadását természetesen angolul fogja megtartani, de a diáin a szöveg pedig magyar nyelven lesz. És felhívjuk a nézők figyelmét arra ismét, hogy ehhez az előadáshoz is tehetnek fel kérdéseket, hozzászólásokat. Miután a felkért hozzászóló, aki Gyürki György lesz, szintén telefonon fog bejelentkezni. És felkérem Mária Lugarót, hogy tartsa meg előadását. Okay. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for the introduction and for the invitation to be here. I'm talking about radioactive nuclei. And why radioactive nuclei are so exciting and interesting? Because with radioactive nuclei, we can measure time. If you have a radioactive nucleus, you effectively have a watch. You have a clock. And the reason is quite simple. It all depends on the radioactive law of decay. This is one of the simplest laws in physics. It basically only says that if you have a certain number of radioactive nuclei, you want to know what is the rate at which they disappear, they turn into something else in time. This rate is simply proportional to the number itself of the radioactive nuclei. It's very, very easy. And the proportionality is given by this lambda, which is a constant. It doesn't change with time. And there is a minus there because the radioactive nuclei, they decrease. Because lambda is not a function of time, this equation is also very simple to solve, to integrate. You do a couple of easy steps and you get to this second equation, which is also very simple and just says that if you have the abundance of a radioactive nucleus at time T0 and at time T1, I will call them N0 and N1, I just take the difference in logarithm and this is the time difference. So this is why if I have a radioactive nucleus, I have a clock. Okay, I have to multiply here by a tau, which is the inverse of the decay rate, but this number we can find in the lab, we can measure in the lab. So, wonderful, I have a clock, I want to understand something more about the formation of the solar system. So what I decide, I take one of my time, T0, as the birth of the sun. Actually, you might wonder, because the birth of the sun didn't happen in one moment, but it was more like a long process. But here, my time zero is the time of the formation of the first solids when the sun formed. And if I take this, I have already half of my problem solved because I have N0. We have the abundances of radioactive nuclei at the time of the formation of the sun from the analysis of meteoritic rocks and the little inclusion that we find in them. In the lab, we can measure these. So I already have a long list of numbers, and this is part of them. Actually, these radioactive nuclei, these are about half of them. I just selected the ones that are mostly well known. And I want to show you this list because it shows you what is the large variety of nuclei that we can play with. So we have nuclei that are very light, like the aluminum is very light, it only has mass 26. But I go up to nuclei that are 100 times heavier, like the curium 247. So this is a huge variety. And not only that, but their mean lives also vary a lot. The aluminum decays in 1 million years, but the samarium 146 in 100 million years. So I can use them to measure different type of time interval. They are clock, they can measure different lengths. Then we have here in the third column the reference isotope, because when there is the analysis of meteorite, we cannot get the absolute number of a nucleus. We always measure it relative to another one. And so this is the reference table or long-lived isotope that people use to measure these radioactive nuclei. And then we have in the last column the ratio as they are measured from the laboratory in the early solar system. And I want to highlight that some of these nuclei, we know them at the level of 5%. So these, I put the three question marks there because we have some systematic problems in these measurements, so some of these are very much still under debate. But in general, we have some amazing data, and I want to use it. So half of my problem is solved, not by me, by people who work in the lab on meteorites to make this very high, amazingly high, high precision measurement. Okay, so what can we do? We have the sun. We can go, for example, forward in time. So if this is the line that shows time, we can go forward. And this has been done extensively. It is not what I will talk about. So basically, people have worked with radioactive nuclei to build up a detailed chronology of the formation of planets in the solar system. I don't have time to talk more about this. I want to bring you one example, the formation of the moon. We know that the moon formed 200 million years after the sun because of the analysis of these radioactive nuclei. And this is one example, but you can look at this paper if you want to learn more. What I am interested in is the other side of the story. Can I say something about what happened before the birth of the sun? And here you can already see that there is some more trouble because I don't have any rocks from before the birth of the sun. So how do I cannot measure in the lab N0 and N1. I have N0, but what is N1? I cannot measure it. This is coming from some theoretical idea, scenario, prediction that I can try to make. So I want to try to develop a detailed chronology of the events that predated the birth of the sun. This is what I want to do. And to do this, I have to choose what is T1, first of all, what kind of time intervals can I measure, do I want to measure? And then, once I choose that, how do I find the abundance of radioactive nucleus at that time T1? You can see it's not a very simple, a simple problem. Okay, so now let's focus. Now I will zoom in and show you a qualitative description of the events that predated the birth of the sun. So now we focus on the left side of this plot, and I go into a bit more details. So what is this, qualitatively speaking, prehistory of the matter that we have now in the solar system? We think we can divide it in two major phases. The first phase is very long. Is the Milky Way age until the sun was born. So say about 10 billion years. And this involved a lot of stars that were born and died before the formation of the sun. Thousands of stars, hundreds of thousands of stars. All these stars, depending on their mass and where they were born, and if they were in a binary system, they live, they die. And when they die, they throw out the elements of which we are made, of which our world is made, everything from the carbon, oxygen, uranium, lead, and everything. This is one phase. But then, to actually form a star, you have to be in a stellar nursery in a colder region of the interstellar medium. So this is what we call a stellar nursery, a star formation cloud, and it has to be not the turbulent, hot interstellar medium. It's a special place. And then, we don't know how long it passed, and we formed the sun. So this is an interesting time, because to know more about the stellar nursery can tell me more about the circumstances of the birth of the sun, and if they were special or normal, if the sun is a normal star or not. Interestingly, we don't know almost anything about this a priori. So that's why the radioactive nuclei becomes so important as a tool. And now I just apply my tool. This is easy. I just do this. If I have the exponential decay, I can move from T0 to T1, and I choose T1 to be something that tells me when this stellar nursery was born, so I long how much time it elapsed. And then I have N0, N1, and the problem is solved. N0, I already said, I have it from the meteoritic data. Now I am interested in N1. how can I define, how can I find a number to put in there? And then I can solve the problem. So this number, as I said, is not an experimental number. We have to build a theory. So we have stars that produce radioactive nuclei, then they throw them in the Milky Way galaxy, and somehow they evolve. We have to model these. So now, again, I'm going to zoom in to the left side of this slide and go into more details about what happens in the Milky Way in the terms of the chemistry of the Milky Way. And this is what some people call the cycle of matter in a galaxy. It's pretty much what I already explained, but with a few more details. So basically, you have stars that are born in the stellar nursery. The stars evolve, and depend on their mass, they can take billions of years if they are like the sun or low mass, or they can take just millions of years if they're more massive. Then we have stellar winds, supernova explosion. If we have binary system, different type of supernova, neutron star merger, black hole mergers. We have a lot of events. And these events, they can all throw out chemical elements. These chemical elements are ejected in their surrounding. They feed back into the interstellar medium, and then you form new star, then you start the cycle again. We can model these with a code, with some computer codes, and this is what we've done. We want to do it for radioactive nuclei. So we want to know the abundance N1. It would be the abundance of a radioactive nucleus in the interstellar medium at the time when the sun was born. And this is quite simple, because you can see, as time passes, the ratio of a radioactive nucleus to a stable nucleus decreases. This is easy to explain, because the radioactive nuclei reaches a steady state, because the more you produce, the more it decays. If you remember, the decay law depends on how much I have. So it will reach a steady state between these two processes. But the stable nucleus does not decay, so you just accumulate it. So necessarily, the ratio goes down with time. We model this, and you see we have an uncertainty area. This is the blue area, because the galaxy is not that simple. As you can imagine, we have uncertainty in the star formation rate, uncertainties how much gas is in stars, uncertainties about infall and outflows with the medium around the Milky Way itself. And we try to account for all these uncertainties, and that's why we get this band. And then we look at the time predicted by this model, when the sun formed. This is when there is enough ion, as much as we have in the sun, and I solve my problem. I have N1 is the number I can put in there. So this would be the end of the story, but it's more interesting, because the problem with these models is that the interstellar medium is considered homogeneous. So it's instantaneously mixed. And this is not reality. If you have a stable nucleus, it doesn't matter too much. But when you have a radioactive nucleus, the radioactive nucleus decay in a certain time scale. And so this approximation does not work if you want to do it properly. So what happens? I will try to explain it a bit more figuratively. So if I am here and I am in a certain space of the interstellar medium, a certain little parcel of gas that will end up being the solar system. I have a star that produces a radioactive nucleus and throw it in. Then there's no star continuously producing radioactive nuclei. The stars are discrete events. I have to wait. I have to wait a certain interval. And while I wait, I decay. So the crucial ratio is the mean life and the time interval between different injections. And here we have two regimes. If the mean life is much shorter, I add the radioactive nucleus, and then before the next addition, I'm gone. I have decayed. And so I have the top panel of the figure here, where my abundance is zigzagging and hovering between zero and a maximum value. But if my mean life is longer than the time between the additions, then I can keep the memory. I remember the previous events. I don't forget about them. I keep some of the nuclei that came from those events. And in this case, I don't stay close to zero, but I can build some higher numbers. And this is what it shows in the lower panel of the figure. The situation is complicated because if the addition was at the constant rate, say every 10 million years, I get the blue line, which is obviously quite systematic. It just goes up and down. But that's reality, again, is not that simple because the addition could happen once after 20 million years, once after five, I don't know a priori. So we have studied this statistically by doing random additions. And this is one example, the red line, where you see that the uncertainty due to this process is bigger than if we could only choose a constant interval, but we cannot do that. So what we did a statistical study. We ran 10,000 of these cases, and then we could do statistic and get an error bar about this process. And the result is depends, obviously, by these two different regimes. When I can build a memory, I can also build a distribution function. I have an average, and I have an error bar. When I don't build a memory, I cannot do that. We had to invent something different. And we decided it would be interesting to know what is the probability that the radioactive nucleus that we see in the solar system only come from one event. Only what it has the memory of only one event. And of course, the shorter the mean life, and the more likely that he forgot about everything that happened before. So this is the plot on the right. So if the tau divided gamma, the mean life divided interval, gets shorter and shorter, I basically see more and more just on one event. This is quite powerful. I will show you in a minute. Okay, now I have a methodology. This is not the end because this is just the temporal homogeneities. We have spatial homogeneities. We're working on this. So it's half of the story, but we're still working on this. But anyway, we are curious. We want to start applying it to something real. This is just theory. Something real are my nuclei here. They exist, the radioactive nuclei that we see in the early solar system. This is the same table that I showed before. I will focus on the top seven. One of the reasons I do this is because the top seven, as you can see, they're all heavy. They're all heavier than ion. Ion is 56 in mass, so these are heavier. And I studied the origin of these elements for 30 years, so I thought this is a very good place that I can apply my knowledge, is looking at these nuclei. Okay, so which stars produce these nuclei? Now I have to go a bit into nuclear physics to show you how they look like and how can we produce them. So this is a nuclear chart. It's basically the periodic table extended in an extra dimension, because here we are interested in isotopes. So the periodic table, you add a proton, and in this chart, you're moving vertically. But we also have another dimension where you move horizontally and you add neutrons, because nuclei is much more important how many neutrons and protons they have. I want to know both. On this chart, I am plotting there everything in the universe is in this chart. Every matter, baryonic matter in the universe is here. The black line are the stable nuclei. And they go, and the pink and blue and other colors, they are radioactive nuclei that we can observe in the laboratory. There are others out of this chart because we cannot observe them. So you see, we start from hydrogen and helium at the bottom. So you have two black boxes next to each other. One is hydrogen 1, one is deuterium. Helium is helium 3 and 4, and so on. You go to carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, all the other common elements, aluminum, magnesium, silicon, etc. And you end up to lead. Lead is still quite low in the nuclear chart. There's still 4/5 of the nuclear chart are elements heavier than iron. And how do we produce them? They have more than 26 protons in their nucleus. They have a strong Coulomb barrier. They will not capture a charged particle. It just cannot get close. But we have neutrons. We can put neutrons as close as we want because they don't have a charge. So the way to produce this element is via neutron captures. And I will show you a little detail. So we have two types traditionally of neutron captures, rapid and slow. The rapid neutron capture had a lot of media attention in the past few years because we finally identify one of the possible sources in the galaxy neutron star merger. So we saw the gravitational wave event connected to a short gamma ray burst. So that was a neutron star merger event. And luckily, we also saw a hypernova there, which is extremely rare event, which we believe is powered by the radioactive decay produced by heavy nuclei made by the R process. So it was outstanding result that finally we can see an R process direct observation for the first time. The slow process is easier because we know since the 50s we observe the spectra of giant stars and we see elements made by the S process. So this is easier, we know where it happens. Then we have another process, the P process, because there's a few nuclei, about 30, 35, that cannot be made by either of those, and they are proton-rich, so there is a P process. To explain a bit better, I will zoom in that region here. So the red line is the S process path. You capture neutrons. So in the nuclear chart, you're jumping from one block to the next in the horizontal, going to the right. But then at some point, you produce an unstable isotope. In the S process, the unstable isotope, it's a slow process to capture a neutron and decay. So it will decay. And so we have this red line that zigzags up the black boxes. The R process is the opposite. Is the rapid process. So when you produce an unstable nucleus, it is more rapid for it to capture a neutron than decay. So you are producing extremely neutron-rich material. We are going out of the slide, out of the window of the building, because these are very, very neutron-rich. Their neutron density 10 to the 25, like in neutron star mergers, you can imagine. But then when the neutron finish, there's nothing you can do than decay to the stable isotope of the mass that you produced. So the R process here is represented by the blue arrow. There is the yellow box there that is not made by any neutron capture process. It cannot be reached. So this is one of these P strange isotopes that are difficult to explain. As you can see, I also circle the blue box there because this is one of my isotopes. That's iodine-129. It lived 15 million years. It's on my list. And now I hope I convince you that it's an R-process isotope. So that's the first one. R-process isotope. Plutonium and curium, there's no way we can make them with slow process because the slow process stops at lead at bismuth, the last black boxes in the chart. Beyond that, you keep on decay instead of capturing neutrons. So these other two guys, actinides like uranium and thorium, they can only be made by the R process. Then I have two isotopes, the samarium-146 and niobium-92. They are on the other side of the black stability boxes, and they are P isotopes. And finally, the last two, they can be produced by both, by the R and by the S process. I can reach them in both directions. Okay, now I want to put everything together. This list of isotopes with the methodology that I discussed before. The list of isotopes here. Now I'm removing the plutonium because I'm not 100% convinced about the early solar system number, so please, for the moment, we are working on this and I leave it out. I have six isotopes from three different processes. How do they behave relatively to the galaxy? So what is their mean life relatively to the time interval between events? The R process I just mentioned, we believe it comes from rare events because compact mergers are rare. They don't happen very often. They're not around the corner. So we believe that the time interval, there is a consensus, it should be between 100, 500 million years. This is a huge interval, but we cannot do much better. But because their mean life is about 20 million years, I'm sure I am in this regime. So I can determine the time of the last event, and this is what we did. So if I go back to this picture, I can identify one of those last stars that contributed to the matter in the solar system in that specific situation. It's about 100 to 200 million years from before the formation of the solar system. The big uncertainty is due to this gamma. At the moment, I cannot do much about it. But we have a bonus here. We have our process event that everybody's chasing to understand better these events. Now we have one. We can see it in these isotopes. And we were very lucky. We first noticed something quite trivial. You can see that iodine-129 and curium-237, they have pretty much the same half-life. This is quite a crazy situation, because then the system of them, if I take the ratio of them, the equivalent half-life is the multiplication of the two divided the difference. So I get 5 giga-year for this system. It's very long-lived. This means that their ratio didn't change from the last event to the early solar system. The early solar system is telling us what that our process event produced. So this is just what I just said. If I take the ratio of radioactive to a stable isotope, I get the zigzagging that I already discussed before. But if I take one to the other, it's flat. It's not changing since the time of the last event. So this was very exciting. So I go into all the literature and I get, what is the number? What is this ratio? I get all the numbers from people who do this analysis in the lab. I get 438. And this we call it the magic number. Do exist an R process event that can produce this number? I have no idea because I am not an expert in R process modeling. So we have to talk to the people we work with in the US and in Germany and tell us, can you find a model that produces this ratio? And they did. So this was good. We are not completely out of nature. The problem with the R process is that we don't know the site. So neutron star merger, they have ejecta, so these are dynamical sites. They have a disk, that's another type of situation. Then there's black hole neutron star merger. Some type of rare supernova can also produce it, so on the bottom there, it's different astrophysical site. And then the nuclear physics is unknown because we're going out of anything we can measure in the lab. We have to use nuclear physics modeling, so that's the top. But as you can see, we found some solution in the disk ejecta of neutron star mergers. So now we can even say something more, a direct observational constraint. This would be the second one for the R process so far, after the hypernova. Okay, but I continue with this. These are just little exciting digression, exciting for us. Then we move to the S process. To the S process, well, first of all, if the last R process event happened 100 million years ago, and these S process isotopes, they decay much faster than the other, the mean life is half, they forget that event. What we have in the solar system is mostly what the S process made of them. Lucky, so then I can constrain them only using the S process. The problem is that I don't know what is gamma for low mass stars that make the S process. So at the moment, I am open to all possibilities. If gamma is greater than 20 million years, I am in this situation, and I can define when happened the last small, slow mass star that produces process event before the formation of the solar system. I don't have time to discuss manganese 53, but this is very interesting because it's mostly a product of type 1a supernova that are the merger or the accretion of white dwarfs, and they are important in general in astrophysics. I can time those two. On the other hand, the P process is the opposite. The P process, we don't know how it happened, where it happened exactly, but it's supernova. Supernova are much less rare than neutron star mergers and Coppler mergers, and they travel really fast in the interstellar medium. We think that gamma is small. The mean lives are high, so I have the other situation when the mean life divided the gamma is greater than 3, and I can this time not sample the last event, but find actually the N1 at that time with a certain uncertainty given by the statistical study, and this is what we did. But the P process is a bad child. No one really knows it. No one really understands it. Here I assume that both those isotopes come from type 1a supernova is one theory, and they don't work with each other. As you can see, we have problems here. But if I assume that the S process also behaved this way, then I can find self-consistent solution also with the ion 60s and other isotope that is interesting and I don't have time to talk about. So this is the point where we stand now. And now to the second part of the talk. It's like, why am I so interested in trying to understand the circumstances of the birth of the sun? Why am I chasing this time so strongly, trying to understand how much time has passed between the birth of the stellar nursery and the birth of the sun? Why? The main reason is that the shortest-lived radioactive isotope, like the aluminum-26 I mentioned at the beginning, has a 1 million half-life, most likely come from phase two. It doesn't have a long life enough to survive much within a phase two. So everybody thinks it comes from something that happened close in time and space to the birth of the sun. And this isotope is interesting for the issue of habitability. Why is that possible? What's the connection between radioactivity and habitability? The connection is that radioactivity is also heat. With radioactive decay, you can produce heat. I'll show you a quick example. The aluminum-26 is the most famous one. So aluminum-26 is a nucleus. I put it in a rock. It has 0.7 million year half-life. It decays into magnesium-26. Now we see it in the rock, so we see there was something strange, and it is aluminum-26. But the angular momentum of aluminum-26 is 5, and magnesium-26 is 0. So it has to lose some energy. So it doesn't decay to the ground state of magnesium-26, but to an excited state. And when immediately it decays to the ground state, you release a 1.8 MeV photon. And if you have as much aluminum-26 as we know was in the solar system, this is quite a bit of heat. Interestingly, these gamma-ray photons, we observe them in the galaxy by satellite observation, spectrograph of these high-energy photons. So there is aluminum-26 in the galaxy produced by stars. We see it in the Milky Way. But put that photon into a rock. Put that photon into one of the first planetesimal that form in the early solar system. These are rocks of about 10, 30 kilometer radius. It will generate heat and it will melt it. So we have the melting of the core, and the core will then mix, so you end up with an ion core. This is where ion meteorites come from. So this happened in the solar system because there was aluminum-26. So it changed the thermomechanical evolution of the planetesimals. And if the planetesimal was beyond the snow line, so far away from the sun, that there was ice there, in principle, it would have been made by chemistry, half ice and half rock. But then put some radioactive decay in there. The ice melts, the water degases, the water goes around, maybe the chemistry changes, and then it degases. So you lose a lot of water here. This is a very nice picture from Tim Lichtenberg's paper last year that show quite nicely what happens here in the two situations. So if you are at the left side of the figure in the blue area, it is a hypothetical case with no aluminum-26 or very little. Then you have planetesimal accrete and that making planets like the Earth. But while they accrete, they stay water rich and you end up with an ocean planet. On the other side, the red bit is where there is enough aluminum-26, like in the solar system, or even more, who knows. In this case, as they accrete, the planetesimal dehydrate, and then you end up with a planet like the Earth, which is water poor, or only about 1-2%. So this is very relevant because we want to know if other planets in the Milky Way, do they behave like the blue region or the red region? So what is the common situation? And so the question is, are the other planetary system aluminum 26 rich or poor? We don't know. The problem is that we don't even know why we have aluminum 26 in the solar system. So this is the question. Why was there? There are two major classes of thoughts. There is the more traditional idea from the 70s that there was something local, one star, one supernova, one wind nearby to where the solar system formed. So you need to have a star dying next to the solar system being born. This is quite unusual. And then you inject the aluminum 26. But even this, you can inject it when the disk is already formed. You can inject it in the cloud and trigger its collapse. We don't know. Or you can think that during phase two, if phase two is long enough, if the stellar nursery was large, you have different generation of stars, and they evolve, and some of them will pollute this star-forming cloud, so that all the stars born there will more or less feel something and have aluminum 26. This is a more common situation, maybe. And now I'll finish with a slide. I made this slide to scare people, because when one approaches this problem, there are a lot of literature. At the bottom is a selection of papers. I try to take the more representative. And people take a paper and they think, this is the solution. Well, each of these papers has made at least three levels of assumption in the scenario they are investigated. So we have to be very careful when you're looking at that. Do we have multiple sources or one source, for example? When did the pollution happen? Or, of course, we need short-lived stars because we are in phase two is short. But massive stars that live short, they can have winds or they can explode. So all of these make different ramifications. So I want to just warn people to be careful when they pick up one of these papers because it's always a very specific case. And the problem in the literature today is that there's no consensus. No one agrees with each other. No one even cites each other often, as you know how it goes. And so this aluminum 26 was discovered in 1977. We still have no consensus of why it was there. It was actually predicted in the 50s because someone said, we need a radioactive source in the solar system. It should have been aluminum 26, then it was discovered. But still, we don't know its origin. And this, as I said, has important implication about the statistic of stars like the sun and if the star is special or not. And just to finish off, I hope it is quite clear how radioactive nuclei can be used to better understand the birth of our star, of the sun, the circumstances of that birth, the type of stellar nursery, if it was born in a big family or in a small family and all this. But then we need to understand first the nuclear physics, the stellar production, and the Milky Way galaxy, the evolution of the Milky Way. So it's a lot of ingredients going there. For aluminum 26, we still don't have an answer on why it was there, but we know it has important implications for the planets. And because my project is still running for about 2.5-3 years, I am hoping maybe in 3 or 4 years we can say something stronger about both the circumstances of the birth of the sun, the aluminum 26, and in the end, how special is the Earth in the Milky Way. And I thank you for the attention. Thank you a lot.
Köszönjük szépen az előadást. Thank you very much for this exciting talk. It's quite amazing that you can go back in time before the birth of the sun, analyze the composition of the pre-solar system, and draw conclusions about habitability on that. Before taking questions from the audience, we would like to connect with Dr. György Gyürki from Debrecen, from the Institute of Nuclear Physics, Atomki. Hát most kapcsoljuk Gyürki Györgyöt, aki előre bejelentett hozzászóló. Úgyhogy kérem a kollégákat, hogyha a vonalban van, akkor adjuk be a hangját. folyamatban van a... És közben pedig fölhívom a figyelmet ismét arra, ami a képernyőn látható, hogy ezt a telefonszámot föl lehet hívni, és további kérdéseket föltenni az előadónak. Jó, tehát vonalban van Gyürki György, úgyhogy kérem, hogy szólaljon meg. Hát ugye ez az első ilyen eset, hogy a közgyűlésünk online zajlik, és ennek is ez az első fázisa, ezek a tudományos előadások. Azt hiszem, leginkább a probléma az a hagyományos telefonvonallal lehet, nem pedig az egyéb eszközökkel itt. Hát amíg meghalljuk a debreceni kolléga bejelentkezését, addig kérdezem a hallgatóságot, az itt jelenlévő 6-8 személyt, hogy van-e kérdésük az előadáshoz. Maria, while we are waiting for the line to connect, can I ask a question?
Yes. Okay.
So you mentioned that it's very important that this short-lived radioactive nuclei heat the planetesimals and thereby the evaporate water. How about the gravitational collapse of these little bodies? Because for larger bodies, as far as I know, it's very important also to produce heat. So where is the size limit where this situation becomes
important? So actually, the work by Tim Lichtenberg analyzes all these because it checks different size planetesimals. And of course, as you say, the size has an impact as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are many more effects that go into planet formation. I am really not claiming that this is the main effect, but it is one important effect that we need to keep in mind and not forget. But there are heating, for example, these rocks, then they can heat when they also collide. This is another important part of the story. But I focus on the radioactive nuclei to try to bring it together in a sense. But definitely.
And did you single out aluminum 26 because it's very abundant and short-lived?
Okay, so this is something I haven't touched at all because it's an extra complication. How do we know aluminum 26 was there 4.6 billion years ago if it decays in 1 million years? We don't see live aluminum 26. That's already extinct. It's all gone. But we see magnesium 26. We see enormous amount of magnesium 26 where there shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And we see that it correlates with the magnesium divided the aluminum abundance. Mm-hmm. The aluminum divided the magnesium abundance. So the more aluminum is in a rock, the more magnesium 26 we see. That's when people thought, oh, it must have been aluminum when it started. So it is a mix of chemistry as well as the radioactive decay. Yes. So we see the daughter excess. Oh, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes. Okay, I see Gyürki appeared on my screen, so maybe he's on the line.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we hear you. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Sorry for this technical problem. So thank you very much, Maria, for this very nice presentation. And let me have my short comment on this. And in this comment, I would like to emphasize again one of the points which you mentioned at the very beginning of your talk. And this is the precision of observations. You talked about the material composition of the solar system at the birth of the solar system, and you mentioned how precisely we know these values. And not only this, but in the beginning of the 21st century, the precision of different astronomical observations became extremely precise. It's enough to mention the gravitational wave detection, which you also mentioned shortly, but I can talk about some classical astronomical observations, like the detection of very very rare elements in stars, or the analysis of meteoritic samples, what you also mentioned. So the precision of these observations are very, very precise now in the 21st century. And based on these very precise observations, astrophysicists can create very nice models for the different astrophysical processes. And you are one of these astrophysicists who can use these really precise observations to create models. And I am a nuclear physicist, so I work in Debrecen in the Atomki Institute. So I can see this picture from the nuclear physics point of view. And often my feeling is that now in this picture, the nuclear physics is the weakest point. So sometimes the models are very precise, the observations are very precise, but the underlying nuclear physics knowledge, which we have, may not be precise enough for these astrophysical observations. You mentioned the decay of long-lived isotopes, and sometimes even the half-life of these isotopes are not known with good enough precision. Or you mentioned different processes of nucleosynthesis, and all these processes involve thousands of nuclear reactions, and we have to know the parameters, the details of these nuclear reactions. And this is the task of nuclear physicists, like what we do in Debrecen, to study experimentally these nuclear reactions. And nuclear physics is an old science, so it's almost 100 years ago when people started to study nuclear reactions. And now, with these very precise astrophysical observations and modelings, it turns out that our knowledge in nuclear physics is still not enough or not precise enough to fulfill the needs of astrophysics. And I would like to ask you to comment on this problem and to tell us something more about the need of astrophysicists from the nuclear physics community. So what are those areas in nuclear physics where we could contribute to the better modeling of astrophysical processes, astrophysical scenarios, like what you study or in general in the 21st century astrophysical models? So please try to emphasize a little bit more the nuclear physics part of this research, and where nuclear physics, experimental nuclear physics, can help the astrophysics community in their work.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Well, I could talk for another hour, so I will try to focus on a couple of issues. It was in the table, the half-life of samarium 146 is not well known. Some people, it's always been thought to be around 100 million years, and then an experiment came and gave it 70 million years. This changes the age of the moon as well, a little bit, by the way. It's difficult to measure, because something that decays in a million years is not something that you can count very often, but this is one example that is quite outstanding. For me, this is crucial. And in fact, all these research projects, I kind of started in 2014, when I realized that hafnium 182 is produced by the S process. Before then, everybody thought that was only produced by the R process. And this was sometimes it's just a lack of the communication enough for this, but that we realized that the decay rate of hafnium 181, that is an unstable nuclear, lives 42 days, doesn't increase at the stellar temperature as much as people thought, because there was one energy level in this nuclear that actually didn't exist. So the nuclear couldn't couple to that energy level and increase the decay rate. And so this we published on an important journal. And it's quite something quite basic, because energy levels are something that people assume, presumably they are well known in nuclear physics, but still, actually we found a big mistake in there. And thanks to measurements in 2003 that we could actually improve the situation here, even basic information like energy levels. And I could talk more about branching point, neutron capture cross-section, the reaction that produce neutrons, for example, as you know, like neon 22 alpha N produces neutrons that produce hafnium 182 is not well known enough. We still have these uncertainties at the back of our mind. And then, of course, I mentioned the R process. With the R process, this is also in nuclear physics, is the big topic. Like, how do we move in the laboratory away from the stable nuclei to reach, to understand even just the mass of the nucleus we don't know, so that we can constrain better the nuclear models that are used for the R process? So, I mean, I could keep on talking for another half an hour, but I hope I gave a flavor of what you were asking.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thanks for the comments from Debrecen.
Thank you very much.
Okay. See, I see another person trying to connect to us, Laszlo Sarka, a geophysicist. Please, Laci, if you are in the line, you can ask Maria or make your comment. Igen, halljuk most már a hangod. Jó.
Maria, 2 weeks ago, a paper was published in the monthly notice of Royal Astronomical Society by Fujimoto et al. And they wrote that they observed the anomalous distribution of aluminium 26 is due to some nearby recent supernova. What do you think about it?
Well, some nearby supernova. Well, this is a very old idea. 1977, Cameron and Truran thought, proposed that a nearby supernova injected aluminium 26. And not only that, but that it made the protosolar cloud collapse. So it was a consequential event, because having a nearby supernova is so rare that if you make it the cause for the formation of the solar system, you maybe can get away with it. The problem I get with often again is the missing of communication, because you can take about a nearby supernova, make it produce aluminum 26 and put it in the early solar system. But you also need to check all the list of isotopes that I showed. You need to check ion 60, you need to check hafnium 182. What would happen to them? And most of these models, all supernova model, overproduce ion 60. I give one example that is famous. So normally people maybe think, I'll just take a supernova and make a very fancy model of phase two, but I only look at aluminum 26. That's why in my project I thought, no, I need to look at the 19 isotopes I have, because they all have to be explained by the same scenario. And this is why I am not convinced about looking at the problem only from one side, because then you have issue. Manganese 53 would be overproduced as well. We are also doing this kind of study, but from the nuclear physics point of view, rather than sophisticated modeling is great. But then you need the yields from a star, you need the reaction rates in there and the yields, so you need to put it all together. And that's why at the moment I reported all the possible scenario, and I'm not actually convinced about anything in particular. I hope this...
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for the comment from the audience. I don't see any other questions from the audience. So we thank you again, Maria, for this wonderful talk and for taking the questions.